Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. We'll be looking at all the week's security news in just a moment with Adam Boileau, and then it'll be on to this week's sponsor interview with Ryan Callumber of Proofpoint. And that is a great chat, actually, about how attackers are turning compromised O365 accounts into code execution. We'll also talk a bit about detecting nefarious activity in the minefield that is O365 and Azure AD environments. So do stick around for that interview. It is a good one. But yes, let's get into the news now. And Adam, last week I was pretty certain that the problems being experienced by the DarkSide ransomware crew were possibly as a result of some US government action. But according to this piece by Ellen Nakashima at the Washington Post, and keep in mind she's a very, very solid journalist on this stuff, that is not the case.
Yes, we did speculate last week that was one of the options, and you know, there were plenty of other ones, exit scams or attacks by other attackers. But yeah, the reporting does seem to be this one wasn't US Cybercom, and perhaps, you know, you and I were looking for the sort of thing that we'd like to see.
Yeah, a bit of wishful thinking, maybe.
Yeah, definitely, a bit of wishful thinking there. But I mean, certainly some of the sources are saying, look, do you really think the US government could have pulled together an operation like that in a couple of days and gotten all the paperwork done and all the sign-off and the committees? And like, that's just not going to happen. And that's pretty compelling, sadly.
Yeah, so I mean, the consensus seems to be that it's some sort of exit scam. The DarkSide have just rolled up their operations and run away with all the Bitcoin while saying, oh, we've been under attack. Yoink. basically, which is a pretty nice ruse. But I don't know. I mean, it's still entirely possible someone's messing with them.
Well, exactly. I'm sure there are a bunch of people that are kind of angry with, you know, the amount of focus they brought to that scene, that community, and, you know, stealing their Bitcoin at that juncture, you know, and blaming it on the US government. You know, pretty reasonable option if you were trying to make some fast cash and perhaps you already had some in, you know, an insider in the group, you know, using that as an excuse. There's plenty of ways that can go down, and it's, you know, a pretty dog-eat-dog, you know, cutthroat sort of place.
Well, I believe you just called it a community, which I thought was quite funny. The community, you know, the crime community.
But yeah, so there's certainly a lot of bad things that could happen, and we have certainly wished a bunch of bad things to happen. So, you know, regardless of who ended up with that Bitcoin, you know, if it turned out to not be the ransomware crew, then yay, I guess.
Yeah, Dan Gooden's actually got a funny story up on ours talking about how some of the, you know, the crime forums, they're having very serious threads where they're judging DarkSide and, you know, sort of running a trial by thread.
Yeah, it's quite a funny insight into, you know, and I guess that's why I use the word community, because they do have a set of standards about how these things are supposed to work. And like this particular forum, I think you have to kind of pay into like an escrow account or into a, you know, some kind of account that's run by the forum so that they can resolve disputes if there is one. And of course, DarkSide's lodged something like, I think, $1 million worth of Bitcoin to resolve disputes in this community. And this is the process kind of unfurling where everyone makes their claim and then the board admins kind of adjudicate and decide on, you know, who's supposed to get their due for pen testing. You know, and I'm making scare quotes here, pen testing these people and dropping ransomware on them because they didn't get their you know, portion of the payout afterwards. Yeah, adjudicating these disputes and divvying up the cash, which does sound very much like a, you know, like a professional services body.
It's like a tribunal, you know?
Yeah.
Like a sports tribunal. We actually had a write-in from a listener by the name of Adam Slagle, and he had a really funny idea about all this ransomware stuff where, you know, he was saying, look, you know, a lot of this stuff is because Russia is giving safe haven to these crews. You know, why don't we do the same thing? We could give criminals in Five Eyes jurisdictions a pass to attack targets in Russia. Let's see how they like it. I mean, what's interesting though, I mean, of course it's just a joke idea, but it, when you actually say it out loud, it does a pretty good job of drawing out what these incentives look like. Do you know what I mean? It's just it's an idea that when you hear it, you're like, that's a ridiculous idea. And then you go, but hang on, if you did that, wow, it would be something, which kind of explains the situation we're all in at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great suggestion because, I mean, you know, yes, you could have criminals do it, or, I mean, I'm looking around the office, you know, where I'm recording at the moment, looking around the rest of my team and going, you know, maybe it would be easier to hit our billable targets for the month if we were doing crime rather than legit pen testing work, you know, legit security consultancy, because, I mean, sales process is easier. We don't have to do reporting like that. You know, it's a lot of places to have efficiencies.
Yes, indeed. But you don't want to get Novichok'd. That's the only downside with this plan. Or microwaved while you're on vacation.
I mean, yes, the Russian embassy is not that far from my office, and perhaps they could hit us with a microwave. So, probably not the best plan overall. Now I think it through, like full spectrum response, perhaps not exactly what we, you know, would like to be receiving.
Now, look, just going back to the dark side and colonial stuff, of course, because, you know, there's still some residual coverage to clean up on the whole colonial thing. One of the things is we do have some clarity now that colonial did actually pay a ransom. And this has pissed off the US Congress something awful, as they would say.
Oh, yeah. Certainly the degree of cooperation that Colonial had with the government is being kind of called into question. And then the fact that they pay the ransom without kind of really being very clear that that was what was going on has, you know, ruffled some feathers. And I mean, the idea that you would pay at all, has got, you know, obviously there's a lot of people who are of the opinion that you shouldn't pay them because it encourages the overall crime.
That's what's funny about this whole story. It's like there's all of these Congress people kind of having their, you know, making their first comments, and they've clearly, you know, only very recently started thinking about this, right? They're having the conversation that we were having years ago about this stuff. And ultimately, I think Colonial did the right thing. I mean, I don't think they even used the recovery tools, but you want to make sure you got that key. You're talking about 45% of the liquid energy of the Eastern United States, and you're not going to pay the $4.4 million? I mean, can you imagine the questions Congress would be asking if they needed that key, didn't have it, and the energy stopped flowing? I mean, They would be being asked, why didn't you pay? It was only $4.4 million, right?
I mean, yeah. I mean, exactly right. I mean, the rest of the world does have to kind of catch up to where this conversation has already gone, right? All of the, you know, chips are kind of already in play for this, and they're only just kind of understanding it now. And yeah, I mean, I expect Congress will be debating full disclosure, you know, in give them another 3 or 4 years.
Yeah. just getting with the times, you know, getting up to speed. But don't worry, everyone. The US federal government has a solution to this pipeline security issue.
Finest.
I mean, this is amazing. The TSA is issuing a cyber directive, which will instruct pipeline operators to report cyber incidents to the federal government, which is a great idea, fair enough. But it doesn't really specify that they should actually do anything that would put them in a position to detect the incidents that they're supposed to be reporting to the US government. So I don't know that this is going to achieve an awful lot.
I mean, baby steps, right? I mean, I guess having to tell the government is a start, right? And then requiring them to look, I guess, you know, in several years' time with lots and lots of work and lots of, you know, committees and standards and things, maybe we'll get to the point where they're encouraged to actually go look. And then maybe further on down the line, we can encourage them to not get hacked quite so often.
Yeah. Now, look, let's turn our attention to this ransomware incident in Ireland, which has, you know, affected the entire country's health system. The government ruled out paying for the decryption capability from the Conti ransomware crew. It looked like that crew actually coughed up the key for free and is now turning this into a "we'll release your data if you don't pay" sort of shakedown. That, of course, happened after the whole Colonial thing kicked off. So I think someone in that group decided that it was going to be inadvisable to hold an entire country's health system to ransom and decided to cough up the key. That appears to be what's happened here, but that system is still not back up and running. It's going to take weeks to put it all back together again. That seems to be where we're at on this Ireland issue.
Yeah, that does seem to match what we've seen. We don't have a real insight into the motivations of the ransomware crew for coughing up the keys for free. But yeah, I think you're probably right in your assessment that it just seemed a bit much. Whether they managed to then get some money out of them for the, you know, not disclosing the information, I guess we'll wait and see.
It's too little, too late. Oh, we destroyed your entire computing environment. Here's a key that'll let you, you know, gradually bring it back up over a few weeks while people are denied radiology. I don't think that's going to have quite the smoothing effect that they're hoping for, you know.
Well, I mean, this is a great reminder that just paying the ransom isn't a magical, you know, press the button, everything comes back. And, you know, businesses that haven't been through this, organizations that haven't been through that, you know, may not necessarily understand that that's, you know, that this is still a really complicated process. And, you know, much like when you go and, you know, pay a pen tester to break your stuff and they give you recommendations that are super impractical because they've never actually built stuff for a living, the same thing applies. Like, we've got ransomware crews here who probably never cold started an entire entire health system, you know, from scratch, even with the key material available.
And I think so, we can do a bit better than probably. I would say they have certainly not done that, actually, Adam.
Exactly right, exactly. And so, yeah, even if you get the keys, right, I mean, you're still stuck in a whole world of pain and there's so much work to do, you know, just turning everything on from cold start in the right order in any reasonably sized IT environment is non-trivial.
Yeah.
Right? You know, most people have never even drilled or exercised that. So, you know, even with key material, yeah, it's going to be a while. It's going to be a hard time. It's going to be interesting to see what the Irish government end up, you know, kind of choosing to do about this.
Yeah, Catalan's got a write-up too at The Record about how the FBI's released some information on this ransomware crew Conti. It looks like they've hit an awful lot of organizations, 400 orgs worldwide, 290 of them based in the United States. They also hit things like 911 call centers.
And I mean, like, what's it going to take, you know?
we're heading into broken record territory at this point.
We certainly are. Yeah, we've definitely had that conversation on the show a few times. But, I mean, you know, it's complicated because, I mean, also, you know, the Conti versus crews using rented Conti infrastructure versus, like, you know, it's quite a, you know, it's a complicated and nuanced kind of thing to even figure out, like, who's attacking what and what are the, you know, what do the patterns look like and, you know, who do we, you know, who should we target? Who should we blame for this?
Now, a topic that is near and dear to our hearts is the topic of insurance premiums as they relate to cybersecurity incident coverage. Looks like premiums, according to this piece by Sean Lingus over at Cyberscoop, premiums are up anywhere between 10 and 30% in the 12 months to late 2020, which is interesting. I think we're going to see a continued escalation there, and more exclusions too is another thing this story points out. There's more and more exclusions from insurance policies, particularly with regard to ransomware, and premiums are going up. And I just have a feeling that this is going to be a upward spiral in terms of the costs to get coverage against this stuff.
Yeah, that absolutely does seem to be the case. You know, the lucky few who've managed to be paid out, you know, for their ransoms, you know, may not be, you know, that would be a very small group of people, I think, in the end, because they're starting to see, you know, that this is at a scale that's difficult and that their data, like that they're basing the premium prices on, is maybe not representative of, you know, A, the historical environment, but B, how things can change so quickly. You know, one crew can show up with a particularly competent approach and just make such a big change to the landscape, and, you know, pricing that into something you sell as a multi-year premium on a, you know, as an insurance product is just super difficult. And they're going to have to adjust and kind of build some of that uncertainty in.
Ransomware is not like earthquakes. Basically, the modeling doesn't quite line up quite the same. And I should point out too that is a write-up of research out of the US Government Accountability Office. It's not some hokey sort of vendor press release type thing. That research seems actually pretty solid. We have a new Iranian threat actor targeting Israel with wipers disguised as ransomware, according to this piece by Catalin Kimpanu. Ah, the Iranians with their wipers. yes.
I sure do love the wipe things. And this particular one, I think it's from a group called Agrius. They previously operated the Deadwood wiper. They built a new one. They used ransomware as a cover. So, you know, they drop it in the environment. It actually deletes a bunch of stuff and then tells you that you can go negotiate and give them money. But it doesn't actually look like, you know, a financially motivated thing. It's just, hey, let's just distract people while we let the wipers run.
Yeah. Yeah, and speaking of malware disguised as ransomware, well, I don't know if that's quite the case here, but Microsoft has put out some info on a Java-based malware called Strat, which apparently just like changes the file extensions on a bunch of stuff and pretends that it's ransomware. I mean, we should do that, man, you know? Charge for unlock tools that just rename files back to their original extensions. We could do that.
I mean, you could certainly claim it was the fastest decryptor on the market, you know, without having to do any expensive crypto heavy lifting or anything. But yeah, but this does seem to be a bit of a weird one. Like, it's got all of the regular remote access kind of capabilities to, you know, let you exec code and move files around and get, you know, remote access via graphical console or whatever. But yeah, pretends to be ransomware, just renames files with a .crimson extension. And yeah, it's kind of unclear whether it's like the same thing, whether it's kind of just to distract people with, whether it's incompetent. Or, you know, whether it's with something else. It seems like a strange...
Yeah, I mean, it was just weird enough to include in the news. That's basically why it's there. It's nothing like, you know, number one threat. I just thought, that's funny. Now, look, something that is, you know, very, very much a more serious topic. Israel apparently bombed two targets in Gaza that were, the IDF says, linked to Hamas cyber operations. One being an office where they operated from, and the other being apparently an apartment government, the IDF referred to as some sort of, you know, hideout for their cyber operators. No word on whether anyone was killed or not, but this is, you know, this is not the first time this has happened. They did something similar in 2019. At that time, they said it was I believe the thinking was that it was a force protection measure because these operators were collecting information on the movement of Israeli troops at border checkpoints, things like that. But, you know, again, this is an issue where we've seen, where we've seen a kinetic response to computer stuff.
Yeah, and it's certainly really, I guess, you know, on the show we've often, you know, we've talked about, you know, kinetic response to, you know, ransomware operators and other kind of cyber things. And, you know, it's sometimes it's good to be reminded what this really looks like and, you know, kind of how sobering it is to, you know, see that really played out, right? And yeah, I mean, it's such a complicated situation over there, and it's really, you know, it's distressing to watch from the outside.
Moving on, and the Russian CERT has released a report talking about some attacks that it identified in 2020, and this is quite funny. Dmitry Alperovich already pointed out on Twitter that, you know, Russia likes to talk about how attribution is impossible, and yet here they are with a report about a crew that they're calling foreign cyber mercenaries. No attribution to a country yet, but it looks like, yeah, this is a pretty detailed report out of the CERT, which is run by the FSB.
Yeah, they got a good write-up of initial entry techniques and lateral movement and exfil techniques and so on, you know, typical sorts of tradecraft that you'd see. Interestingly, all of that was done through Russian-hosted sites. They were using, you know, kind of Yandex and Mail.ru and stuff to move data in and out, which makes a lot of sense. If you're operating in Russia and you're a serious player, then that's certainly the way to do it.
Well, that's how the Russians do it to the Americans, right, with Azure accounts and whatever. So
exactly. Although the thing that I found really funny about this was they talk about some of the components, and there's no attribution to actually who this is, but, like, come on, it's called Mailo and WebDevo. Like, in Australia, what's a gas station called?
Yeah, it's a servo.
It's a servo, right?
And if you're Dave, what's your nickname?
Dave-O.
Yeah.
Now, if you want to go get a drink, what shop do you go to? You go to the Bottle-O, don't you?
You do go to the Bottle-O. So, Mailo and WebDevo, you reckon this is an ASD jam, Australia on Russia, flexing.
It's right there in the words. You just got to read, man. You got to read.
Read between the lines. We're through the looking glass, people. moving on, we got an interesting report here from Tim Starks over at CyberScoop looking at a Russian darknet market, Hydra specifically. It's an interesting read, actually, because, you know, it looks like whoever's running Hydra has some sort of protection because the Russian state's been pretty interested in shutting down its competitors. Not so interested in shutting down it.
Yes, exactly. And they've, you know, ballooned with some of the other drug markets, you know, underground markets being taken out. And this is one that is mostly focused on narcotics trading. But, you know, according to the report, like up to like $1 billion a year worth of transaction volumes, like that's no small operation. And, you know, for it to survive, you know, in this case for, you know, some years now, it does kind of point towards, you know, it being, you know, established in its community, perhaps.
Yeah.
With a bunch of, you know, kind of support from the environment. What I did think was interesting reading this was, you know, obviously you can track some of the Bitcoin flows in and out of people been doing this. We've seen, for example, the DarkSide ransomware crew sending something like 4% of its Bitcoins, you know, through this particular thing, presumably to buy drugs, you know, got to keep things going. But that also they are doing things a little more old-fashioned way, like burying money in a forest as a service. So that you don't have to deal with, you know, pesky blockchains. So that's some innovation. Mm-hmm.
That is some innovation. Money burial as a service. You'd really want to trust those people.
Yeah, you really would, right? But now apparently that's a thing, you know, designated couriers, gig economy, anything that, you know, can use the services you're willing to provide.
DoorDash, but for cartels, basically. It's funny, though, because there's even a mention in this story about how Russian law enforcement took down one of its competitors, Hydra's competitors, called Ramp, and according to this story, which was notorious for using tactics like reporting rivals' IP addresses to authorities. You know, that's so funny. That's the thing. They're not that hard to dox, really. I think, you know, it's been long enough with these marketplaces operating and being shut down. They're not actually that difficult to pull down. So this, you know, you might protect the client side with Tor Onion services. You don't really protect the server side, which is kind of not how we expected this to work out, but there you go.
Yeah, and you know, it's certainly interesting seeing how this tech has ended up being used and what the real world kind of like structures that you build on it and the way that people have gone after these kind of dark web services. Yeah, it's probably not what we originally anticipated, you know, 5-10 years ago.
No, we thought the servers were going to be, yeah, quite hidden, but no. But, you know, good client confidentiality. So if you need to buy your heroin, that's you. Not that I'm endorsing you buying your heroin.
Don't buy heroin.
Moving on. And the CETA breach, that's the Swiss company that makes the, you know, passenger reservation system that's used by Star Alliance. We heard rumblings of this breach back in March. Catalin Kimpanu has teased out some of the details of it in a story he published this week, because Air India has come forward and sort of revealed a little bit more information. And holy dooly, the attackers got away with a lot.
Yeah, and this is a really interesting update, because at the time when we reported this back in March, they were saying, you know, oh, it's you know, only really frequent flyer, you know, kind of membership data and some data about travel, because I mean, certainly going after airline systems, you know, to be able to understand where people are makes a lot of sense. You know, if you want to redirect a plane flying over Belarus, you need to know who's on the plane. So going after airline systems makes a lot of sense, and you know, the kind of centralized Star Alliance and Oneworld, you know, are really juicy targets, because you know, you get a lot of bang for your hacker buck. Anyway, Air India had disclosed a bunch of extra details, and the set of data that they describe as having been lost here is pretty more significant, I guess, than what we were originally getting from the airlines, you know, back in March. And, you know, that's his travel history, you know, passport details, payment details in some cases as well, going back 10 years. Which is pretty significant. So,
yes, it is.
Yeah, that's not a great look. And hey, my data was in there. You know, Air New Zealand's CETA customer, member of that particular alliance. So,
well, I mean, so many people's data is in there. If you've ever flown with like United or whatever, they're Star Alliance as well. So it's, yeah, it's crazy. Funny though, that blogger from Belarus who got hijacked essentially by Lukashenko, he'd already been like messaging his friends, telling him that someone had spotted him at the gate, like some goon had spotted him when he was boarding and was like trying to take photos of his documents and stuff. So I don't think he actually got cybered. Not to say your point wasn't relevant, but yeah, in that case, I think he was very much in the fleshed.
The old-fashioned way of doing it.
Yeah, the old-fashioned. I mean, and that's
probably the Belarusian way.
Well, I was just about to say that, actually. That's the Belarusian way. They're still sort of welded to 80s-style European fascist thuggery. So yeah, horrible situation, that one as well. What else have we got here? We got a great story here from Andy Greenberg over at Wired. It's funny, actually, because I've spoken to a person who's quite intimately familiar with some of the events described in this story, and they say the piece is good, which is, yeah, it's always good to hear. But he's written a big feature about the 2011 intrusion into RSA, where, you know, China basically stole all of the RSA key fob seed values and used that to stage an attack against Lockheed Martin. Just a really wonderful feature that really takes us behind the scenes of, you know, things like the RSA incident responders fighting the good fight. It's just a wonderful write-up.
Yeah, I always enjoy write-ups like this that are kind of far enough in the past that people are willing to talk, and you get some of that kind of human perspective on, you know, on rolling incident response, of seeing the attack unfurl, you know, from the inside, responding to it and trying to, you know, draw conclusions about what had happened. And this one, I mean, you know, this piece is really well-timed, you know, now that we've had the SolarWinds thing go past and supply chains all in vogue, it's good to remind people that it's always been in vogue, right? That people have been doing this, in this case, you know, the Chinese, you know, it's worked for a long, long time and will probably continue to work. And this piece is just a really great reminder of what one of those well-executed, you know, through to the end really looks like. And the piece has a number of great kind of personal experiences, including the guy that spotted the exfil happening from, you know, they had some API that would call off into a, quote, air-gapped, unquote, system which stored the seed values, you know, that was pulling them all out, sticking them in a RAR file or whatever, and shipped them off to some box at Rackspace or whatever it was.
Yeah, via FTP.
Via FTP, you know, such a, you know, classic good times. And yeah, he talks about finding the FTP creds, using those to, you know, log into the box at Rackspace, seeing the files that have been staged there, you know, with their exfil seeds material, thinking about it for, you know, like a minute, like, am I going to do something about this? Like, I'm hacking back. Oh no. Goes to RM, you know, delete the file, and it's already been moved and gone.
Yep.
And like that experience, like I feel that
by that much.
I feel that, man. Yeah. And there's no guarantee that was the only copy or blah, 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 but you know, I feel that. And Yeah, what a day at the office, man.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a really great write-up. Everyone can go check that one out. Now we're going to talk about a bit of research that came out of Australia from a consultancy called Skylight. And they did just a great bug chain against Nagios IT monitoring stuff. So yeah, talk us through this one because I know this is kind of up your alley.
Yeah, so this is a set of bugs in the Nagios monitoring system, and they went through and kind of, you know, I guess they were looking for a bunch of comedy bugs for an engagement, and the blog post is a really great write-up as well. It's totally worth the read. They've got, you know, 13, I think, bugs that they reported upstream to Nagios, which they bug chained together to be able to, you know, kind of attack the environment they were going after. In some ways, I don't know that it's surprising that there's so many bugs in Nagios, and certainly the blog post, you get a feel for them being startled at quite how trash that code base is, you know, despite having been around for a long time and being used for a long time. But they describe a very realistic scenario where, you know, distributed Nagios monitoring is being deployed out to customer sites where this bug chain starts with, you know, access to a monitoring sensor in one place and then goes upstream, you know, into the organization. In this case, they suggest a telco perhaps, and they've got, you know, privilege escalation, code execution, ladder movement up through the kind of Nagios integration with the centralized management, and then Privesk and bug chain again. And it's just a beautiful thing. Like, it's really nicely written up, well thought through. They've implemented an entire, you know, kind of command and control framework that, you know, will cease working the second the bugs are patched. But yeah, just good quality hacking and nice to see it done.
Well, I think one of the things that they did here that was really valuable is they chained a bunch of mediums into criticals, right? And that's, you know, you can report a lot of these medium severity issues to vendors and they just won't fix them. And then you show them a bug chain of you absolutely destroying their customers with it, then they might take it seriously. But this used to be an issue going back 10 plus years. This used to be an issue for companies like Microsoft and Adobe wouldn't even patch some of these less critical things. And one of my favorite con talks of all time was still that Billy Rios talk called Will It Blend from, you know, 10 plus years ago, where he took a bunch of medium severity issues and turned them into an end-to-end drive-by compromise affecting a fully patched Windows host.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Being able to chain bugs together and understanding how to use them in context to kind of circumvent a security control or cross the security boundary, like, that's a thing that a lot of, you know, if you're not a hacker or, you know, like a security architect or someone who has to really think about that stuff, it's often not obvious how these things combine together. And as, you know, as security consultants, as pen testers, part of our job is to be able to explain it, and bug chaining, you know, actually weaponizing it, demonstrating it, is one of the ways that we do that.
I think one of the best ways I can explain it is if you go to Adobe and you say, I've got this bug that allows me to write an arbitrary file to disk. And Adobe says, well, so what? You can't execute it. And then you go to Microsoft and you say, I've got this bug that allows me to execute a file in this directory. And they say, so what? There's nothing executable in that directory.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, they don't care. You combine those two things and you've got a browser exploit.
You've got a sweet bug.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, no, but, and, you know, looking at this in context and as a whole ecosystem, as a whole, you know, as a whole system, is what attackers do and defenders kind of need to. And certainly, you know, a blog post like this is a great way of explaining exactly that.
Now, despite the fact that we stopped talking about it for a couple of months, it turns out dependency confusion risk has not gone away, Adam, which is funny. This is another one. That last one was from the Daily Swig. That was a John Layden piece. This one's by Adam Bannister. But yeah, some research from a company called Red Hunt Labs has shown us that, yes, the problem didn't magically solve itself while we were busy talking about, you know, pipeline ransomware attacks.
Yeah, this, you know, we said this was going to have a long tail, and it has a long tail. This set of research has been through GitHub, you know, looking at supply chains for software, and particularly looking for, you know, dependency inclusions that are from, say, domains that have lapsed. You know, places where as an attacker you've got an option to go stick something in. They've done a bunch of work to kind of break that down by, you know, which languages, you know, and say, you know, for example, you know, JavaScript projects tend to have more dependencies than Ruby projects, say, and look at which projects in the ecosystem are particularly important, and whether or not any of those, you know, are vulnerable to somewhere down the dependency chain this kind of attack, and a few other, you know, avenues as well. But yeah, good solid research. And one of the advantages of having, you know, a really big centralized open source code repository like GitHub is being able to do these sorts of studies, you know, at enough scale for them to be meaningful.
Now, you remember like 25 years ago when you wanted to give a BBS a hard time, you would send them that file, which was 1.2 gigabytes of the character A, zipped into a 4 kilobyte zip file, right? And they're automated scanners would sit there and try to unpack it, and you just keep sending it and keep sending it.
The
keep
classic zip bomb. It's a beautiful
not
thing.
Not that I would ever do something like this.
No, of course not.
You know. But, you know, even 10 years later, you could still use that to mess with corporate mail gateways, right? Like similar sort of approach. We're going to talk about that, but for machine learning. And I love this story. I find this really, really interesting. Talk to us about this.
So this research from the University of Maryland looks at kind of denial of service against artificial intelligence inference systems. And the theory here is that, you know, if you're going to do a bunch of, you know, say image recognition or something like that that requires, complicated machine learning system, a lot of that will get submitted off to a cloud rather than processed locally on your device. And there's a bunch of optimization techniques that, you know, AI operators will use to try and, you know, make that, you know, compute in reasonable time. And this is kind of adversarial inputs that will cause that early exit process to just not happen, increasing the amount of load, increasing the cost of processing. And this is interesting because, I mean, you know, one, you can cause kind of denial of service to AI systems in the cloud, which, you know, reasonable avenue of attack. But more generally, this kind of adversarial inputs to machine learning systems is an area of security research that is just going to be huge in the future.
It's a little bit underdone, isn't it, at this stage, right? But I mean, I like this one because they're just focusing on one thing, which is, you know, instead of trying to do that adversarial input to change a machine learning determination or behavior, like, this is just about making the modeling work as hard as possible to the point where you're basically DOSing the thing. And that's pretty cool.
Exactly, like being able to choose a pathological input that makes it go to the worst possible place. And we've seen this with, you know, sorting algorithms and, you know, regular expression engines and, you know, compression obviously was another example. Like, come up with a pathological input that that is valid and correct and maybe even one day we'll finish processing, but it's just absolute worst case. And then the operators have to deal with, you know, how do I schedule load? How do I pay for this? And if, you know, if they're running in a cloud environment where they're paying, you know, kind of by query time or something like that, you know, then there's potential to cause, you know, denial of service in a financial sense as well. But yeah, this kind of algorithmic complexity denial of service is, you know, is one of the key categories, right? We have your volumetric denial of service and algorithmic complexity denial of service. And this kind of, you know, adversarial input to machine learning as a DOS vector, smart, makes sense. We're going to see a whole bunch more research and attacks, I imagine.
Now, China's personal information protection law was approved earlier this year, Adam, and went into effect on May 1. And the Chinese government is cracking down on mobile apps for collecting too much personal information. I believe the Chinese government must be of the opinion that if anyone's going to be harvesting the personal information of Chinese citizens, it should be them, not mobile app things, which when you think about it is a savvy national security idea because you stop app makers from collecting too much information and storing it in vulnerable ways. I mean, that's one less target for your adversaries, isn't it? I mean, it's a good result.
I mean, honestly, this just makes so much sense, right? This is a smart move, and it seems like a relative, you know, more thought through than you would expect set of legislation. And you're absolutely right. It has a number of great benefits in terms of, you know, individual privacy, but, you know, as a nation state, gives them some, you know, less places to get nicked by all the adversaries. And yeah, you're right. I mean, their idea is that they should collect it all, not anybody else. And the funny outcome of all of this, I guess, is that we're in a position where, you know, like privacy controls for the average Chinese citizen
are better than they are in the US.
Probably better than they are in the US, where, you know, all of it gets bought by aggregators and sold to everybody, and, you know, you've got real-time tracking off your cars and phones and whatever.
No, it did occur to me that they've kind of got their GDPR equivalent before the United States, which is just... it's a funny old world.
It's a bit orcs. It's a bit orcs.
This one I only included because I correctly guessed from the headline what the story was about, and I'm sure you did as well. The headline is, and it's another, yeah, as I say, it's another one from Catalan, just a handful of Android apps exposed the data of more than 100 million users. And I, as I went to click it, I'm like, I was saying in my brain, S3 buckets, S3 buckets, S3 buckets, S3 buckets. And I clicked it and I was like, ding, 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 S3 buckets for the win.
Yeah, this is, you know, the kind of perennial research, I guess. We've seen this a number of times over the years where people go through a bunch of apps in the App Store and rummage up, you know, keys for cloud storage or databases or backend services and, you know, kind of go dig through those and see what data is exposed. And as always, there is a lot.
Yes, there is. And it's in S3 buckets. It's always an S3 bucket when it's some Android mobile app. Microsoft continuing to do somewhat useful things, Adam. I'm terribly confused.
Microsoft has released a tool for simulating attacker techniques so that defenders and other people who are interested can go through and exercise things in a kind of a controlled environment. This is building on some work from a guy, I think they used to work at Spectre Ops, that has now moved to Microsoft for doing this kind of attack simulation labs. So far, they've only got one set of things, Golden SAML attacks to kind of exercise, but presumably they're going to build a bunch more. And this, you know, this kind of thing is really necessary because building a test environment to, you know, that's representative enough to do these sorts of things, you know, is pretty complicated. So having it all kind of packaged up makes a lot of sense, and Microsoft are definitely the right people to do it.
I just want to say too, people really should hang around for the sponsor interview this week, because Golden SAML actually comes up. It's with Ryan Callenberg, who's EVP of cybersecurity strategy at Proofpoint. And they actually built some detections for stuff like Golden SAML into their products, their sort of Graph API products for O365 and Azure AD. And they found some too. Like when they rolled out that detection, it was around. It wasn't as common as they were expecting, but they were like, ooh, you know, that was exciting. You know, pushing the button on that detection and watching it go ding, ding, ding was pretty cool. So
yeah, it's always rewarding.
Yeah, that's a really good chat with Ryan, which is coming up in just a minute. So do stick around for that. A bit of intrigue here now, Adam. Google apparently updated its Android security bulletin from early May to say that a bunch of the bugs that were patched earlier this month may be under limited or targeted exploitation, right? Which is an interesting thing to add to that bulletin. Now, these were attacks these were vulnerabilities in GPU firmware code affecting ARM and Qualcomm stuff. Pretty interesting. Shane Huntley tweeted about this earlier. Someone was having a go at Google saying, well, that's a bit vague, saying that it may be under limited or targeted exploitation. And, you know, Shane very generously just wrote a little thread saying, well, look, you know, if we're being vague, it's because we don't know the precise details. Sometimes someone may have given us information that's limited in nature. Sometimes we might have found evidence of an exploit being brokered, but not sure if it's been deployed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's just interesting, though, when you've got Google saying that vulnerabilities in GPU firmware code were maybe being exploited in the wild. So it really changes the way you view these sorts of firmware bugs.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that input, even though it's vague, is still really important, right? I mean, the fact that they have seen maybe some suggestion, you know, I saw one of the other people from Google saying, hey, you know, another example might be, hey, we just saw it on VirusTotal, right? Someone submitted it. The context of the submission looks like it was being used in the wild, but we don't know anything else. And it's still useful information to be able to judge, like, is this just, you know, yet another bug that I don't really have to care about? Is this a thing I actually do need to think about in my environment? And, you know, even if it's vague, that's still, you know, that's more input that you're going to get from your average vendor advisory. So, you know, yay.
Yeah, well, I don't know too many orgs that are in a position to act on intelligence pertaining to GPU firmware bugs used against Android in the wild.
I know, but which is wishful thinking.
But that's another thing that makes it interesting, right? And that's one of the things that makes mobile security, you know, and mobile exploitation interesting in the first place, is the fact that it's quite opaque.
Yeah, it absolutely is. It's a real complicated environment, and people have such, you know, poor control over their fleet of especially beware any mobile devices. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I guess what do when you read that piece of information is a very good question.
VMware, dude. VMware. Let's talk about VMware.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
We're dealing with there's a patch out for a bug that scores a 9.8 CVSS, which is, that is out of 10, too, we should say. It's not out of 12. It's not out of 15. That's a 9.8 out of 10. Which is basically means you look at it and it gives you a shell. And there's a lot of important stuff running on vCenter still.
Oh,
you know,
yeah. Like, this, I looked at this bug and I went, oh boy. Like every internal pen test, you know, every time we want to go escalate access, every ransomware crew in a modern environment, in a modern corporate environment with VMware is going to look at that and go, oh yeah, like that's a good time. So the details are, I'm not 100% sure. The CVSS score implies pre-authentication, but yeah, this is a bug in VMware vCenter, which is the management tool for the VMware virtualization environment. And this is remote code exec onto the underlying platform, you know, as it'll be running as root or equivalent. And yeah, I'm assuming from the CVSS pre-authentication. And once you're there, you have full access to every VM that's under management in that environment. And from there, you can do anything, right? I mean, go ransomware the whole fleet in one go. Why not? And if the backups are virtual, even better.
Yeah. Yeah, so much for we'll just run virtual desktops and that'll solve our ransomware risk, right?
Yeah. You definitely want to patch that. But
yeah. And we'll see. Yeah. I mean, look, one saving grace here is that's not the sort of thing that's typically exposed to the internet. So it's not like these Pulse Secure, like F5 bugs that we've been seeing wrecking everyone.
No, I mean, at least you probably wouldn't put it on the internet, although, of course, it does happen on occasion. But yeah, for an insider, someone who's got, you know, first stage code execution, you know, through phishing or whatever, and wants to go somewhere, you know, and you don't want to go the Active Directory route because that's too well monitored now. Yeah, good yeah. Target.
Happiness is a CVSS 9.8, basically. Apple's fixed a bunch of stuff in macOS. Some malware was exploiting these bugs, and they, you know, it looks like whoever wrote this malware kind of knows what they're doing, because it's about, it just looks like very objective and purpose-driven exploitation, yes. This. So when I read this, I'm like, oof, you know, who was using these ones? But what did you get the same vibe from this?
Absolutely, yeah. This really does feel like someone who actually needs to get the job done on OS X. Yeah. You know, because we haven't seen a whole bunch of, like, you know, common guard and recreational malware on OS X. And so the people who are there generally are there for, you know, for business.
You see fake installers, you know what I mean? Like, that's the stuff that you most see for Mac OS. But when you're seeing stuff that's designed to sort of stealthily get onto a box and it's exploiting O'Day, you know, not the world's most critical O'Day, but this thing was obviously engineered for stealth. And you just think, you know, someone was on target doing this.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, one of the bugs is for bypassing the pop-up that warns you about, like, camera access or screen recording, which are absolutely things that, if you're a real attacker, are just super important parts of your workflow, and obviously you just can't have pop-ups coming up. And so expending a bunch of time to find some bugs in those controls, that's a thing you only do if you're serious and you're using it for real on real targets. There's some oof, right? I mean, it's not, you know, remote code exec in the IP stack, you know, in the kernel or whatever, but these are, you know, real work a day, you know, good honest 0 days, and good to see them patched.
Zach Whitaker at TechCrunch has a story up about Microsoft's announcement that it will withdraw support for Internet Explorer in June 2022. Although I must say, his lead in this story is a little bit ambitious. He says, pour one out for Internet Explorer, the long enduring internet browser, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think because Microsoft is withdrawing support that it's necessarily going to disappear, sadly. He also says stuff like, oh, you know, I'm sure the, you know, half a dozen users who are left will be devastated. So, you know, so having a bit of fun with the write-up, but there's still a bit of IE out there.
There is still a lot of IE out there, and there's a lot of things that require IE. There's a lot of rubbish ActiveX controls that drive embedded equipment and Lord knows what else. So, yeah, I think we all wish that his kind of, you know, loving epitaph for Internet Explorer here was actually true. But, yeah, I don't think it's going anywhere. It's going to be around for a long-ass time. And at least, you know, web devs don't have to optimize their sites and make them work on IE6 anymore, which everyone's very glad about. And, that's good. But, yeah, it's not going to disappear quite yet, I'm afraid.
Well, Adam, that is actually it for the week's news. An interesting mix of stories this week and not the usual sense of complete dread too. But I don't know if that's just because I'm in a good mood or because of the news. It's hard to tell, right?
I think it's probably a relative metric. I mean, we've seen so much terrible stuff happen, you know, in the last, you know, 5 years. That, yeah, like a week where there isn't, you know, an entire national health system being taken out again, then that seems like...
Just the one from last week offline, yeah. And the CVSS 9.8 in vCenter.
Yeah, I mean, like the fact that that's at the end of the news and it's Oh, God.
Good times, good vibes. Great to talk to you, mate, and we'll catch you again next week.
Yeah, cheers, man. I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's security news. A quick announcement now, and Dmitry Alperovich's Silverado Policy Accelerator is hosting a webinar on June 1 titled Competing with China: Opportunities for US-Australia Cooperation. This is a sort of webinar that I think will be relevant to the interests of a lot of our listeners. It will feature former Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, also John Katko, a ranking member of the US House Committee on Homeland Security, Ami Barra, the chairman of the House Committee on Asia, the Pacific, Central Asia and Non-Proliferation, and they'll be joined by a couple of the Silverado people, including Dmitry. So yeah, if you'd like to register for that one, there is a link in this week's show notes. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Ryan Callumber, EVP of Cybersecurity Strategy at Proofpoint. And yeah, we're talking about how, among other things, how popped 0365 accounts are enabling quite a lot of different types of attackers, right? So whether you're into BEC, ransomware, or APT stuff, 0365 accounts are just a great starting point. Attackers are using those accounts to pivot into code execution by jumping into threads with maldocs. That's one example. And there are plenty more that we're going to go through. So in this chat, we talk about that. And we also talk about some work Proofpoint is doing around detecting the big ticket bad stuff via the 0365 Graph API. This is a really interesting conversation, and I hope you enjoy it.
Well, I would say that compromised Office 365 accounts power a huge percentage of the threat landscape. And that's true not just of the ransomware actors. It's obviously true of the BEC actors, and it's even true of state actors. Now, really, the tradecraft is starting to overlap in really interesting ways, which is both an opportunity for defenders, but it's also fascinating to see because the techniques can be mixed and matched and blended in ways that we really hadn't dealt with before. They're not really staying in discrete boxes.
Let's dive into that a bit because it is interesting, right? Because you and I have been talking obviously in preparation for this interview and there seem to be a few threads coming together, right? Like I think it's well established that people are leveraging BEC style thread hijacking to get code execution for various purposes. But what's interesting there is like we've spoken a lot about these rogue 0365 apps as a way to actually hijack people's Office accounts, but we don't often talk about that as a pathway for code execution on the LAN. But that's something we're seeing now, isn't it? We're seeing a phishing attempt to trick someone to OAuth a rogue 0365 app. And from there you go a thread hijack, drop a maldoc, and then bang, you're on your merry way.
Yeah, exactly. And there's nothing that stops an actor from combining these techniques in novel ways. Right? Why wouldn't you use Office 365 to host your payload? Because that's a trusted domain. Why wouldn't you use an OAuth app to compromise that account? Because that means full access. Might also mean persistence. And in some cases, like the Holiday Bear examples, it even means lateral movement. It really is a different world, though, when the actors themselves are kind of defined by their monetization techniques. We think of, oh, these are ransomware actors over here, or their initial access brokers. Or we think of, oh, these are business email compromise actors over here. In the actual practice, a lot of their techniques have started to blur because really all of the same stuff is useful in multiple different ways.
They're outcomes driven.
Exactly.
Now, you actually did a few weeks ago, you published some interesting research, or you were out there talking about some interesting research into the 0365, OAuth app stuff. Walk us through that because that is interesting stuff, like about bypassing publisher controls because that's a thing people can do now.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a really useful way historically to bypass things like MFA to basically get an OAuth app that is malicious installed and trusted to any given user's Office 365 account. And you did some great work on this with DJ Molema and some others kind of unpacking what the security looks like under the covers there in Azure. But really, the controls that Microsoft rolled out here are not only sort of the classic default, deeply insecure configuration that we've come to know and expect from Office 365, but even the publisher controls that they've rolled out are fairly trivial to bypass. The research that we published basically showed a fairly simple technique where you could use any compromised Office 365 account belonging to any random organization to basically do the equivalent of publish an app that basically just looks like a URL. And unless the administrator had specifically gone in and said, my users can't publish things that look like OAuth apps or third-party apps, then that would simply be available for the threat actor across really most of Office 365. Really, really is a good way around those publisher controls. And it is the sort of thing that ends up showing up in lots of other places. The research we published right before that was what percentage of the 3,000 organizations whose threat data we looked at received a threat from one of their supply chain partners. And the number was 98%. And it's the sort of thing that simply works. To your earlier ransomware example, again, that compromised Office 365 account can be used for a whole host of things. Read that inbox, send malicious messages from it, create a malicious OAuth app. It really is a multi-tool for the attackers at this point.
It's funny you mentioned that interview with Dirk-Jan Mollema from Fox IT in the Netherlands. If people haven't listened to that, I should drop a link in this week's show notes so you could find that. That was I was really happy with that interview. I thought it was very, very interesting. You know, he's someone who really knows the Microsoft cloud stuff and how to abuse it. You were among the people who recommended him to me, actually, for the interview. Brett Winifred was another one. So yeah, if people haven't heard that, go check it out, because he did a really good job of walking us through some of the systemic weaknesses in the you know, in the Azure AD and O365 space. But I believe that's led to some interesting work on the proof point side. Those problems have led to some interesting work on the proof point side in terms of looking at how to get some control and detection around some of that activity. Can you tell us a bit about that? Because it is interesting.
Sure. I mean, the first reason that we really dug into this and how I discovered the work that DJ and his team had done is we just started to see an absolute tidal wave of malicious messages come in from Office 365. And speaking of yet more proof point research, shout out to Sherry DeGrippo and team, we actually just published some that kind of quantified that problem. So in 2020, we saw 59,809,708 malicious messages come from Office 365 into our customers targeting them. And actually, Google had an even bigger number. But ultimately, once we started to dig into that and look at kind of why are these things being compromised? Is it just simple stuff like brute forcing and password spray, or is it more complex than that? You know, that's when we really started to look at the sort of issues that DJ understands so well. Because ultimately, compromising Office 365 and abusing it for a whole host of different purposes is something that appeals to basically every type of threat actor at this point. You know, I've started to look back on the Holiday Bear attacks with the benefit of a little hindsight and looked at it as basically six different ways to get into Office 365 and Azure AD, right? And some of those ways are pretty hard to stop, like malicious software updates. But a lot of the post-compromise activity is pretty detectable. And interestingly, Office 365 via the Graph API gives us a ton of tools to detect it. So,
but no one's been doing this. And that was something that sort of shone through in that interview that I keep referencing, is like, you know, it's possible to look for this stuff and see it, but you have to be looking, and no one really is. And vendors haven't really stepped into that space yet, because until that Holiday Bear campaign was blown open, like people just didn't, they weren't quite aware how the extent of the problem, right?
Oh, absolutely. And the different flavors of compromise there were really fascinating. And, you know, credit to the organizations like Malwarebytes and like FireEye that shared a huge amount of information about how those compromises actually occurred. And ultimately, it is a really interesting detection opportunity. So, you know, we do this on the cloud threat side of things, where we're looking at anybody messing around with federation keys and certificates. That shouldn't happen very often. You know, surface principles is another obvious one. Golden SAML was one of those things that sounded absolutely terrifying when you first heard about it. You know, they basically have domain admin because of SolarWinds, and now they can mint access to anything that they want. But as it happens, you know, API access is a lot more predictable than a human logging into Office 365. And you should be able to actually look for a really starkly defined set of patterns.
Well, I mean, the metaphor I keep going back to is you got to look at these things, these OAuth apps and their behaviors. They're kind of like service accounts, right? And apply kind of the same thinking, because that's the thing, you know, you talk to these ML people, but you talk to the ML people about, you know, watching, you know, scouring logs and looking for funny events involving service accounts. And they do pop out like the dog's proverbials, as we would say.
And you're absolutely right. They do. And you can even go with your favorite example of what the Holiday Bear actor did, which was to basically add a new IDP domain federate with federated access as the thing that should frankly ring every alarm bell
You shouldn't have to build a detection for that. That should just be like, as I said, like my desired solution for this is, if that's a feature you want, Microsoft should make you pay for it to turn it on.
We shouldn't have had to build a detection for it, but we did, because one did not exist. And that is exactly the sort of thing that we're trying to look for, like abuse of the e-discovery account. And there's dozens of these things that, again, are really good detection opportunities, because they frankly should not happen as part of the regular course of doing business. But I love that you mentioned the kind of ML side of it, because some of this did not require ML for sure.
Yeah,
we just went through a very, very long exercise to overhaul our detection for basically payloadless BEC style attacks, where it's just about impersonation and it's not about you know, any form of malware or even a malicious link that points to a cred fish page or anything like that. And there, you know, our data science team, if you press them on it, they would say that there's no magic in the algorithms they're using. You know, a nice, well-labeled data set is super useful in catching those sorts of attacks. But when it came to the Office 365 data, there are just things that stick out like sore thumbs. Like there really are a small set of things that should never happen, but enterprise customers probably do need to use from time to time. So building a detection actually does have some value, even though it shouldn't need to exist.
Now, look, you're known for email security primarily. I know you've got some DLP stuff and whatever, but where does this, I mean, I know you're sort of working on productizing this. Where does this sit for you? Because, you know, how do you deploy these sorts of detections? Do you have some sort of product that sits in the cloud that you grant API access and it can read the logs? Or like, what, we, you know, what?
That's exactly it. You know, there, on the email security side of things, there has been a bit of a discussion around, is an API-based approach enough? Do you have a gateway-based approach? And our classic response is the old meme, why not both? Yeah. I wouldn't like to rely on Microsoft or Google for all my telemetry.
Normally deploy as a gateway thing, right? So this is, and that's why I bring it up, is because this has absolutely got to sit somewhere else. I mean, is this being offered as like a checkbox proof point option, you know, or is it a different product line with a different name? Like, I'm kind of wondering.
So the advanced threat customers on the email side of things can add it as a connection via the Graph API, and we will do detection on that. For those that want more full-featured cloud security, you know, we do have a few thousand customers on what Gartner calls a CASB. I continue to dislike that acronym because it's not usually functioning like a broker anymore. It's functioning like a threat detection engine and a DLP engine. That's what most people tend to use it for. But yeah, Graph API into Office 365, and of course, API into the other SaaS applications. Sometimes you end up proxying traffic, but that's less and less common, actually, as these architectures evolve. Actually, even browser isolation can be used to do a sort of a SAML proxy kind of an approach. But yeah, that's an entire cloud threat division that we're not terribly well known for, but is finding some super interesting stuff. I will say that, you know, once we started to look for golden SAML, we found it. We didn't find the holiday bear actor, but we found golden SAML.
That's interesting.
And it was really, really interesting.
How much of it did you find? Because that is interesting. I'm like, really?
It's still not super common, but there's definitely a set of actors who know how to use it because it's a really useful technique. And again, you know, if you're looking to move around laterally in a way that you don't think people are looking for, you know, that is one of those things that most good attackers now have in the toolkit.
I mean, that's cool, right? We're talking about catching some of these big ticket things like, you know, clear signs of pretty serious compromise. But when it comes to like detecting a single lowly privileged malicious OAuth app that some user has added, you know, has granted access to their O365 mailbox, like how easy is that to detect? Because I would have thought it's a little bit harder. And that's really what we started off talking about, is how you can turn that sort of access into code execution. And then from there, you can move laterally and, you know, ransomware an entire enterprise or BEC or whatever the hell you want to do. But really, today we're talking about that pivot to code exec. You know, how easy is that stuff to detect in you know, your experience?
Yeah, you're right that it's harder. And there are some organizations who thankfully never let the horse leave the barn, right? They actually had, they removed the ability of individual users to trust third-party apps. And they basically said admin only for that, which is not actually what Microsoft will recommend. You know, we frequently talk to security teams who have asked Microsoft about this, and they point out user productivity can be impacted by not being able to trust arbitrary third-party apps when you actually follow up.
YOLO, am I right?
Yeah, exactly. But determining whether the third-party app is malicious is trickier than it used to be, because some of them are just straight up obviously malicious. You get classic lookalikes for SharePoint and OneDrive, and you know they're using puny code characters, the same stuff you see in malicious domain names. But what is really interesting now, in my view, and we published some research on this as well, is people using legitimate apps like random third-party email clients and calendar apps and productivity apps, not actually as effectively malware, but basically as a persistence mechanism. If you've got these creds and you want to use this app that's not going to ring alarm bells when it shows up installed and connected to this user's account, why not use random third-party Office suite nobody's ever heard of, but comes from a reputable publisher? You know, this is almost a flavor of, you know, one of the Iranian APT crews used to do this with Zoho and kind of those random off-brand Office 365 and Google Workspace substitutes, where that would become an incredibly powerful persistence mechanism that most people wouldn't be looking for to siphon off email and files. And in some cases, again, you get to legitimate third-party app being used illegitimately.
All right, Ryan Kallenber, thank you so much for joining the show, for that conversation. That was very, very interesting stuff. And yes, you've made a lot of good points. And yeah, it's just depressing, isn't it? Just when we think we got to put it in the cloud, let Microsoft handle it, we don't have to worry anymore. And it's like, oh no, that's just another vector. Great. Thanks, mate. Thank you. But yeah, great to talk to you as always. And I'm sure we'll speak again soon.
Absolutely. Always happy to depress you, Pat.
That was Ryan Kallenber there. He is the EVP of Cybersecurity Strategy at Proofpoint. Big thanks to him for that, and big thanks to Proofpoint for being a Risky Business sponsor. And that is it for this week's show. Don't forget to check out the feature interview I posted a couple of days ago with Tim Watts, the Australian politician. That was really interesting, I thought. And I'll be back next week. And until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.